The Protestant Reformation, with its most memorable scene, that of Luther coming along and nailing his 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg in Germany, that Reformation was God purging a polluted church. It was God coming along and vindicating his own honour and spreading his glory upon the earth. It was God as well peeling back all those covers of darkness that had been spread over the minds of the people during the dark and the Middle Ages, and allowing once more the light of the glorious gospel of his grace to illuminate hearts and minds of men and women again. What if we were to change the picture and use some maritime imagery tonight? Then, from a human point of view at least, the Reformation was a flotilla of chosen little ships and vessels, both large and small, equipped and outfitted in heaven, that were set out there to sail across a sea of heresy and sin, to launch an invasion against the forces of the devil, and to install the crimson banners of the crosswork of our Lord Jesus Christ on citadel after citadel after citadel that formerly belonged to the devil, right across the continent of Europe. There were many events that were going on in the 16th century that set the stage for the Reformation. One was that the world was changing. Royal power was growing right through the nations, and centralized monarchies they were forming. Nations themselves were beginning to emerge. Let me tell you this, there was no credit crunch back then, because money economies were beginning to take shape. Massive quantities of gold and silver were flooding through Europe at the time, and we're told that especially the British and the Dutch and the Italians and the Germans were sent money mad during those years. Tremendous changes in medicine, mathematics, and physics were underway. In 1543, there was the origin of the scientific revolution, and it worked through Copernicus right through to the 17th century, the end of that century, and Isaac Newton would have been the figurehead then. At the end of the 15th century, a new world, that's America, was discovered. So it was a time of exploration and reaching out. Change was in the atmosphere on a global basis. Not only that, the church was corrupt. Simony, which was the selling of church offices. If you wanted to be a priest then, if you had the appropriate money, you could be a priest. If you wanted to rise above the level of a priest and become a bishop and lord it over a few more folk, then with the appropriate donation, you could do that as well. The Pope had resorted to selling indulgences to fund the building of St. Peter's in Rome. The church, as a greedy place indeed, was set there in stark contrast with Jesus of Nazareth and his simple lifestyle. The clergy were lax, to say the best about them. They were corrupt. They were immoral. And all of the people began to figure out rather quickly that here are guys and they're not into the spirit of any of this. Everything that they do is shrouded in complacency and indifference, and they really can't be bothered. John Calvin, commenting on the plea for revival that we have in Psalm 85, verse 5 to 7, "Wilt thou not revive us again, that thy people may rejoice in thee?" Calvin said, in the necessity of reforming the church, first then, the question is not whether the church suffers from many and grievous diseases, for this is admitted even by all moderate judges, but whether the diseases are of a kind whose cure admits of no longer delay. We maintain, Calvin said, to start with, that when God raised up Luther and others who held forth a torch to light us into the way of salvation, and in whose ministering our churches are founded and built, the use of the sacraments was polluted, and the government of the church was tyrannical. The world is changing. Back then, the church, though, was corrupt. People all around were becoming literate, craving education, wanted to read the scriptures above everything. At that time, not only had the printing press been made, But in over 200 cities, by the end of the 15th century, they had a printing press installed, and half of the 6 million books being printed were religious. And people really wanted the Bible. Also, back then, pre-reformers and early reformers had paved the way. There was John Wycliffe, 1320 to 1384 in England, sought to translate the Bible into English, put it into the hands of all the people. You had Jan Hus in Bohemia, Savonarola in Italy. You had in France Lefebvre, you had Erasmus, who's debatable in terms of his reforming character, but he was operating in the Netherlands. You had Martin Luther, of course, in Germany, Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich in Switzerland, the Albigensians, who had been earlier than that, 12th and 13th century France, and the Waldensians as well, who eventually threw their lot in behind the Reformation movement. So all over Europe, there were these lights beginning to flicker, beginning to shine, beginning to burn like torches with evangelical truth. The fall of Constantinople, which was a centre of learning, brought waves of scholars rushing into Europe looking for refuge, and they reminded the Westerners that they came across, you need to get back to the original sources. You need light, you need education, and it spurred on the Renaissance. All of these things coming together produced a suitable environment for a man like John Calvin to arrive and to be used of God. The stage, with everything else happening, was pretty much set for him to stand upon it, for the actor to come. Actor, did I say? Well, I should have used the term admiral, because even allowing that Martin Luther was a most prominent member of the Protestant Reformation, looked upon as a very key figure, and of course he was, I believe that along with him and right at the front of the foremost ship in that flotilla of Reformation vessels, you've got John Calvin standing. Now, back in former years, the admiralty in England, United Kingdom, would have been exercised by a single person. The office is now branched out, and it's a joint command of the Royal Navy. There's a board of admiralty at the moment. John Calvin, back in Reformation times, I believe qualifies for the title of the admiralty. Now, I'm not taking any glory from God when I say that. I know that he is always the supreme head and the king in his church. And Calvin, for one, would have been very keen to say that and maintain that. But he was a massive figure. In the Reformation times, we talk about a stature. I read this week that many Presbyterians greet the news that 2009 will mark the 500th anniversary of John Calvin's birth with a yawn, a roll of the eyes, or even a derisive snort. That's the comment of one author. Then they ask, why are we so dismissive of our forebear in the Reformed tradition? Maybe an answer is apostasy. Because in Presbyterianism today, do they really want to know what John Calvin stood for or what he taught? But the same author goes on to say, well, Lutherans adore Martin Luther. Methodist hearts are strangely worn by John and Charles Wesley. Anglicans even have a sardonic fondness for Henry VIII, but Presbyterians are uncertain about John Calvin and his legacy. Calvin is not a reformed idol. Well, we wouldn't want to treat him that way. But Presbyterians can still recognize and should appreciate how he molded the Reformed churches, how his legacy continues to shape those churches today, how he labored to make the Bible understandable through regular preaching, how he developed a biblical set of ethics and morals that guided those emerging Western political structures, how by his teaching of his preachers and sending them out, he brought education to the masses. It's a tragedy that very few recognize his influence today. But to ignore him is like putting your head in the sand. Calvin's influence towers over everything. One has said it's hard to put your arms round Calvin. Not physically, of course, but in terms of his impact. And they said it's like putting one's arms around the Pacific Ocean. The church historian Shaft identifies the Reformation as the second most important event to Christ's life itself. And at the centre of the Reformation, according to Schaff, stands John Calvin, the greatest theologian since the Apostles and the greatest influence on the Church since Peter and Paul. If he is that, we ought to know something about him. Spurgeon said, "Among those born of woman, there has not arisen one greater than John Calvin." During a recent holiday in Spain, we took a ride in what was called the Magnus Colossus, a wooden roller coaster in Terra Mítica. Now, official statistics show, and before you gasp, yes, there is a roller coaster database on the internet. They show the length of the thing is 3,772 feet, to be absolutely precise about it. There's a drop of 118 feet. It reaches a speed of 57.2 miles per hour. Doesn't sound very fast, but when you're going over a creaking structure for quite some distance, it's pretty much fast enough. Magnus Colossus is a fair enough name for it. And that too would be a fair description of what John Calvin was in the Reformation movement right across Europe. But the question is, while he had reached this high status, this place of high influence, how did God bring it about? How did God choose his man, propel him forward, and equip him for the task that he appointed him to? So we're thinking not only of his status, but of his schooling here. Calvin was born 10th of July, 1509, in Noyon in France. At the same time, Martin Luther would have been 25 years of age, and Luther had just begun to teach the Bible in Wittenberg in Germany. John Calvin was born into a staunch Roman Catholic family, and if you quickly scan over the family tree and pick out names there, you'll find that he came from fairly lowly stock. His paternal grandfather was a barrel maker and boatman. His mother's father was an innkeeper. However, his own father, Gerard, had improved his lot in life, scaled up some ladders, and had become a successful lawyer. His practice brought him into the society of the nobility within the town, the local gentry, the cathedral clergy, and in fact the local bishop employed Calvin's father as an administrator in the town's cathedral. Now John creamed off a few side benefits through these connections. He was to be educated privately among the aristocratic of society, the Dumont Montmores, and so his playmates, classmates, all the rest of it, would have been the higher-heeled persons in society. As a result of these church connections that his father had formed, he would be given one of two chaplaincies in the cathedral. So as far as he was concerned and his family were concerned, it was really set up for John Calvin. Gerard, his father, planned a career in the church for his son. It wasn't so much the father saying or the mother saying to the sons or daughters back then, "Well, what would you like to be when you grow up?" It's just, "We'll tell you what you're going to be, and this is your option. One option, our will, you do it." And the father wanted him to become a priest. And the path to that career meant that he had to go through the University of Paris. There he would begin on an arts course, then go through 9 years of theological doctorate. After that, he'd be falling back on those, the Dumont Moors in Noyon in France, relying on them, pulling a few strings for him so that his own talents could elevate him up to a fair level of preferment. So when he was 14 years of age, his father sent him to Paris to study theology. First at the College de Marche, in preparation for his university studies, he gets in there and he's 7 subjects. Grammar. The ones that you would really like today: rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music. And towards the end of 1523, he transferred to a more famous college, Montaigne. Although the new teachings, as they were viewed at that time, Martin Luther and Jacques Lefebvre, were spreading through Paris, Calvin, in his studies, he was so closely tied to the Roman Church, and he was studying at their institutions, and those institutions were untouched by all of the reform movement going on in Germany, and Calvin's in there, and in the darkness, he's steeping his mind in medieval theology, and for a long time, hears nothing about the Protestant Reformation. He changed his name while he was there, Johannes Calvinus. In French, it became John Calvin. The arts course was almost completely finished by the mid-1520s. He'd shown himself to be an excellent student, a good Latinist, proficient in the philosophy that was taught in those days, qualified to take up the intensive study of theology that now led before him. But as he was going towards that theology, suddenly the plans changed. When he was 19, his father, Gerard, fell out with the church back home. Changed his mind, told his son, get off that theology course and study law. And John, dutiful son that he was, submitted to the change in plan. And for the next 5 or 6 years, he was at the University of Orleans and Bourges. And again, he showed a lot of distinction in his new field of study. Now the Renaissance had swept in. That was simply a new approach to the arts and scholarship, a revolution in thinking and taste. By this time it was apparent all over Europe, people were saying, you don't just have to have Greek as an add-on for your language, you need to have it now as a necessity for a scholar's equipment. They had the printing presses churning out cheap copies of the Greek and the Latin classics. There were already half a dozen editions of the Greek New Testament, and as many of the Hebrew Old Testament. And this revolution was going full steam at that time, nearly like what it's been over the past 20 years in our society. I mean, 20 years ago, did you all have a personal computer at home? Probably not. With its word processing facilities and its desktop publishing and its CAD drawing programs. Well, that's what the printing press and its introduction was like back then. And Calvin came under the influence of the Renaissance. And during these years, he mastered Greek, and at a later time, Hebrew. He developed a taste for good writing. He read widely in all of the classics. He went into the philosophers of the day and added Plato to the Aristotle that he already knew. And he successfully completed his course in law. But then his father died in May of 1531, when Calvin was 21. And while he mourned the death of his father, it freed up the path before him. He was able to turn from law and go back to his first love, the classics. He published his first book back then, and I'm sure you'll really want to know it was a commentary on a Latin treatise, De Clemencia, by the Roman philosopher Seneca. Your education is now complete. That was published in 1532 when Calvin was a mere 23 years of age. But during those years, when he's studying law, when he's into the classics, a more profound influence than the Renaissance had come and arrived at his doorstep. By the mid-1520s, Martin Luther's position was clear. In many countries, Luther was building a strong following. His friends were disseminating Luther's teachings and ideas by printing. They were reaching to a wider audience. There were Lutherans now in Paris, in Orleans. No matter where he went, there were Lutheran preachers. And John Calvin met them by 1527. He had struck up friendships with some of these Lutheran men. He had become reform-minded himself, and he was brought into contact, therefore, with the message and the spirit of the Protestant Reformation. We're talking about his salvation now. Some people say, I can't point to an exact time when I was converted. You know, the way others have the date, right down to the time of that day, as to when they pass from spiritual death to spiritual life. Others say, well, I can't pinpoint it with that degree of accuracy, nor could Calvin. And reading his writings, we don't know the exact time or the precise circumstances of his conversion to the evangelical faith. For Calvin himself, the important thing was not when it happened, not how it happened, but the change itself and the results of that change. And let me be honest, if there were more people in the world today who were more interested in the change that conversion is, and the results of that change in their lives, rather than being able to just fire out a date, I for one would be much more content. What we do know is that by the year 1533, something dramatic had happened in his life to pitch John Calvin into the ranks of those who were standing in wholehearted devotion to Jesus Christ and among the ranks of the Protestant Reformation. He befriended a preacher, the rector of the College Royal in Paris, called Nicholas Cop, and that friendship spelled trouble for Calvin. Cop got up and preached at the winter term at the University of Paris. Because he preached Reformation doctrine, he was branded a heretic. He was calling for reform in the Roman Church, and he was called to account by the Parliament for his Lutheran doctrines. Cop fled out of the city of Paris to Basel. Calvin was forced out of Paris as well. And this connection with Cop was so close that some people suspected Cop was actually preaching from Calvin's manuscript. Calvin had written the message that Cop delivered on that occasion. And then persecution broke out in Paris, and what precipitated that was some people had come out and pinned up material around the city that were anonymous attacks against the Mass, and they posted them on public buildings, and that stirred up violence within the city of Paris. And a general persecution broke out, and King Francis I said it was against the cursed Lutheran sect. So by 1533 we know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Calvin had definitely crossed the line to embrace the Reformed faith. Now, he very rarely speaks about himself. Isn't that so unlike some? But it's quite refreshing. But he does write about his conversion in the preface to his commentary on the Book of the Psalms. God drew me, he said, from obscure and lowly beginnings, and conferred on me that most honourable office of herald and minister of the gospel. What happened first was that by an unexpected conversion, he tamed to teachableness a mind too stubborn for its years. For I was strongly devoted to the superstitions of the papacy that nothing less could draw me from such depths of mire. And so this mere taste of true godliness that I received set me on fire with such a desire to progress that I pursued the rest of my studies more coolly. Although I didn't give them up altogether. Before a year had slipped by, anybody who longed for a purer doctrine kept on coming to learn from me. Still a beginner I was, and a raw recruit. He gives more clear comment on his conversion later, and he tells us when, lo, a very different form of doctrine started up, not one which led us away from the Christian profession, but one which brought it back to its fountain, to its original purity. Offended by the novelty, I lent an unwilling ear, and at first I confessed, strenuously and passionately resisted to confess that I had all my life long been in ignorance and error. I at length perceived, as if light had broken in upon me, in what a sty of error I had wallowed, and how much pollution and impurity I had thereby contracted. Being exceedingly alarmed at the misery into which I had fallen, I made it my first business to betake myself to thy way, O God, condemning my past life, not without groans and tears. And he goes on to say that God, by a sudden conversion, subdued and brought his mind to a teachable frame. He was a soul that out of the darkness had seen the light and begun to cry, O Christ, he is the fountain, the deep, sweet well of love. And he says, I flamed with an intense desire to make progress. Some people are happy to be saved and stuck. Just get the license, just get the guarantee of heaven, and be content, and we'll often do as you please. Calvin says, and this is the litmus test for real conversion, I flamed with an intense desire to make progress. It's interesting to note that he later adopted a personal seal or a logo that identified him, and it signified his willingness to sacrifice everything to the service of God. And the seal that he had pictured a burning heart in a hand, and that hand was lifting that burning heart up towards heaven, and it had the motto underneath, promptly and sincerely in the work of God. And it was an emblem of how Calvin felt in his heart towards the service of God, and his service was nothing short of wholehearted. We're on to that fourth heading, service. What form would his ministry take? Calvin knew what he wanted. He wanted peace, he wanted quiet. Who doesn't? But he wanted that to promote the Reformed faith by his writing. You know, just give me a little quiet corner somewhere and I'll study, and I'll read up, and I'll learn the writings of Luther and all of these other guys and the theologians within the Reform movement, and I'll bring it all together, and I'll distill it and analyze it and produce writings that will help the others come to faith in Christ and set up Reformed churches right through Europe. He felt that's what he was cut out for by nature, a writing ministry. And sometimes we think we're to go down a certain street in the will and plan of God for our lives. And then we discover that God has different plans, and he has that for many of us. And he tears up our script. Far better to say, teach me thy way, O Lord. Lead me in a plain path. When the persecution we mentioned had broken out in Paris, Calvin escaped, was forced into hiding, didn't go out of France at that moment in time. He was here and he was there and he was somewhere else, just hiding away from the authorities who were hunting him down. But eventually he found he had to leave the country altogether. He got over to Switzerland and Bâle between 1534 and 1536. He was there, and to redeem the time, well, what better way to pass the time than to study Hebrew? I was glad to leave that, getting out of the Whitfield College of the Bible. Essentially, extensively, leave it. But he studied Hebrew over that. Then in March of 1536, he published the first edition of the book that his name will always be associated with, the Institutes, and that production would go through five enlargements until its final form in the year 1559. Now, when I say Institutes, probably doesn't convey very much to us. If I give you a translation of the title as Principles of the Christian Faith or Instruction in the Christian Faith, that would mean more. It was intended as a basic manual for readers who wanted to know something more of the evangelical faith. The first part of the title expressed the aim, the principles of the Christian faith containing almost the whole sum of godliness and whatever is necessary to know about saving doctrine. Calvin said all he had in mind in writing these institutes at the beginning was some elementary teaching by which anyone who had been touched by an interest in religion might be formed to true godliness. He said, I labored at the task, especially for our own Frenchmen, for I saw that many were hungering and thirsting after Christ, and yet only a very few had any real knowledge of him. The first three chapters took up 81 pages in that original 1536 edition. They're the heart of the book on sacraments, and on the church, justification had been thoroughly dealt with at the time. He was also wanting to make clear to all of those outside of evangelicalism what these reformers really stood for, because there was confusion and all kinds of allegations and misinformation running about as to what the reformers were about. But years later he tells us about another obligation that he felt press upon him as he wrote his institutes. "But lo," he said, "while I lay hidden at Baal and known only to few people, many faithful and holy persons were burnt alive in France. It appeared to me that unless I opposed the perpetrators to the utmost of my ability, my silence could not be vindicated from the charge of cowardice and treachery. This was the consideration which induced me to publish my institutes of the Christian religion. It was published with no other design than that men might know what was the faith held by those whom I saw basely and wickedly defamed." And so if you ever have Calvin's Institutes, and I'd encourage you to buy a copy, you'll get one cheap on eBay. You're bound to. Everything's cheap on eBay. Remember, as you hold the Christian Institutes, Calvin's Institutes, that the theology for John Calvin that's contained in them was forged on the furnace of burning flesh. Fellow believers, brothers and sisters in Jesus in the country of France were being burned at the stake, horribly killed at that time. And he said, "I need to do something. I need to raise my voice. I need to tell what is the faith in Jesus Christ." And you know something? I'm persuaded that it would do our theology wonders today. And our interest in solid Bible teaching, it would really spur that on. If there was more at stake whenever we opened our mouth for Jesus Christ, we'd love our Bibles more if there were a higher cost than what we have to pay today. We'd defend the truth with more vigor than what we do today. In 1536, France gave a temporary amnesty to those who had fled out of his country. And Calvin returned. He put a few things in order, and then he left, never to go back again. And when he left, he took out his brother Antoine and his sister Marie with him. And he intended to go to a free city, Strasbourg, and continue this life of, he's falling back on it, peaceful writing. Still imagined he was going to be able to do that. But he wrote later to a friend, "I have learned from experience that we cannot see very far before us. When I promised myself an easy, tranquil life, what I least expected was at hand." A war had broken out as he made his way from Paris through to Strasbourg between Charles V and Francis I, resulted basically in troop movements, and those troop movements obstructed and blocked his road to where he wanted to go, to Strasbourg. So Calvin and his little country had to do what some guys might have to do tomorrow, and do a detour. He was rerouted into what we now call Switzerland, and then he was approaching Strasbourg from the south. Where he got to was not Strasbourg, but Geneva. It was another safe town. It had recently declared for the Reformation just a month or two earlier, and he puts himself up and the family that were with him in an inn for the night, and they were going to resume their journey in the morning and get out of Geneva and get up the road towards Strasbourg. But before that evening was out, it had come to the ears of a fiery leader of the Reformation in the city of Geneva, William Farrell, who was there, that the author of the Christian Institutes, he was in the city. And Farrell at the time was beside himself with work and with worry as well. He wasn't much of an organizer, but he needed to organize and establish a newly formed church in Geneva. So he only had a small number of helpers. He needed somebody to come. And as he looked at this situation of Calvin coming in, he thought, "God has given me a man. He's an ideal assistant. I need to meet him." And straight to the inn went William Farrell, and he said to Calvin, "I want you to be my assistant." Calvin dug his heels in. He was a scholar, he said. He was a writer, not a pastor, not an administrator. "William Farrell, you'll have to get somebody else. I'm headed for Strasbourg in the morning." Now, Farrell was rather baffled by this, frustrated as well, and he swore a great oath that God would curse all of Calvin's studies unless he stayed where he was in Geneva. Calvin always had a fairly tender conscience. And he said, "I felt as if God from heaven had laid his mighty hand upon me to stop me in my course. And I was so terror-stricken that I did not continue my journey." It was a meeting that changed the course of John Calvin's entire life. changed the course of history, not just for Geneva, but for the world. You know, history is full of what ifs. Our lives are probably littered with what ifs. If there had been no troop movements or skirmishes blocking the route to Strasbourg. If they had reached Strasbourg within a day or two, as was the plan. If Calvin had settled in Strasbourg for life, the history of Europe, of England, of America would have been vastly different. But as we look back, we marvel at the providence of God, who arranged armies to position his pastors where he wanted them. Never again would Calvin work in what he called the tranquility of studies. He never did have, from that day on, peace and quiet. From this stage, every page of the 48 volumes of books and tracts and sermons and commentaries and letters that he wrote would have to be hammered out on the anvil of a fully-fledged, fiery, pastoral responsibility. And he takes up the position that Farrell gave him in Geneva, first as professor of sacred scripture. Within 4 months, he was appointed a pastor of St. Peter's Church in the city, one of three parishes in the 10,000-strong town of Geneva. And in everything that followed, this belief that God had called him there by design and not elsewhere, that never wavered apart from once. He and Farrell were a bit hot for the city to handle. They didn't like the way they were going about things and reforming very strongly within Geneva. And so the city councillors banished Calvin and Farrell. Some 18 months later, Calvin breathed a sigh of relief. Glad to get shot of the place, thought God was mercifully releasing him from the crush of pastoral duty so that once again he could give himself totally to his studies. He got to Strasbourg. But he found another reformer there, Martin Bucer, who learned about Calvin's new availability. And he did the very same thing that William Farrell had done to get Calvin to stay in Geneva. Calvin writes, that most excellent service of Christ, Martin Bucer, he's pretty graceful in this, employing a similar kind of remonstrance and protestation as to that which Farrell had recourse, drew me back to a new station. He basically preached to Calvin about Jonah. He said, now I see Jonah in you. You're running in the wrong direction, to the wrong place. And Calvin again took fear instead. Now his ministry in Strasbourg turned out to be the happiest period of his life. For 3 years it lasted. And he served as a pastor to about 500 French refugees in Strasbourg. He taught the New Testament. He wrote his first commentary in the Book of the Romans. He put out the second enlarged edition of the Institutes. And while it had been just a few chapters, it was starting to swell in size. From 6, it reached 17 chapters. He had formally settled up as a catechism form. Now he had a broader format. He based all of his writing in the Institutes around wisdom in its two parts. Number one, the knowledge of God. Number two, the knowledge of ourselves. And now for a very appropriate romantic interlude. Maybe the most, don't get your hopes too high. Because as I read his biographers, Calvin was one of the least romantic of guys that God ever formed upon the earth. But maybe the most important providence during that 3-year stay in Strasbourg was finding a wife. Several had tried to get Calvin a wife. He was 31 years of age. Numerous women had shown interest. Calvin told his friend and matchmaker, William Farrell, who had tied him down to Geneva those years ago, what he wanted in a wife. The only beauty, Calvin said, which allures me is this, that she be chaste, not too nice. Don't know what he means by that. Or fastidious, fussy. Economical, I want that. Patient, likely to take care of my health. He found his partner. after, we are told by one biographer, some prosaic wooing. I'm tempted to let you read that in a dictionary and find out what prosaic wooing is all about. It's unimaginative courtship. Work that one out. But the wife that he got came in the form of an Anabaptist widow named Idalette Stroudure, who had joined Calvin's congregation with her husband John, but in the spring of 1540, John had died of plague, and that August, she didn't wait around too long, the 6th of August, the same year, 1540, Calvin and Idalette were married. She brought a son and daughter with her into Calvin's home. But after the 3 years that he had an enjoyable time in Strasbourg, Geneva wrote and they begged him to return. They had decided, because of the chaos that had broken out in the city since Calvin and Farrell had left, that maybe Calvin and Farrell, his sidekick, weren't really so bad at all, and so the city council rescinded the ban on Calvin, and they even held him up as a mighty man of God. It was an agonizing decision for Calvin. Should I go back? I'm enjoying it here in Strasbourg. They want me in Geneva. He knew that life in Geneva would not be pleasant. It would be full of controversy, full of danger. And earlier in October, he had said to Farrell that, I prefer not to go. If ever a call came from Geneva, I'd prefer not to take it. In fact, he said, I'd rather die 1,000 deaths than return to Geneva, because I fear Geneva more than any other spot on earth. Yet, he said, because I know that I am not my own master, I offer my heart, visualize his motto, I offer my heart as a true sacrifice to the Lord. That hand holding that burning heart up to God promptly and sincerely in God's service, again he had adopted that policy, and it's a good policy to adopt. On Tuesday, 13th of September 1541, Calvin entered Geneva for the second time to serve the church until he died some 23 years later on the 27th of May 1564. And his return from Strasbourg to Geneva meant that he went in through the city gate second time, a lot different to the way he had come in the first time. Back then, the first time he went to Geneva, he'd just been a passerby staying the night, no more, until William Farrell prevailed upon him. Now, when he goes back for the second time, he is an important, influential person, a close friend of the leading reformers like Martin Bucer and Philip Melanchthon, is the author of three more books, and he goes back into Geneva as an established theologian. Big name in the Reformed circles at this time, and he was able to use that to his own moral advantage within the city. Now, we're told when he went back, he curbed his temper and his self-will. Who thought these fellows weren't men of like passions as we are? And he learned to be patient with the opposition, and in a moment you'll see how patient he was. But his mandate was again to organize the church in Geneva. He did that, but his extremely heavy workload meant that he also played a full part in day-to-day ministry. He preached twice every Sunday and every day of alternate weeks. I'm going to steam through this paragraph in case you get ideas as to what all pastors should be doing. In the weeks when he was not preaching, he lectured three times. He was the Old Testament professor there. Took his place regularly at the consistory, kind of a counselor, met every Thursday. He was either on committees or incessantly being asked for advice about matters relating to the work of the deacons. But it shouldn't be thought that he was standing in Geneva as a kind of dictator, or that he was the ruler of Geneva. He was simply appointed by the city council, and he was paid by them. He could at any time be dismissed by them, as he had been back in 1538 along with Farrell. He was a foreigner in Geneva, not even a naturalized citizen until near the end of his life. But his great authority was a moral authority, and they came with him, and they consulted with him, and he asked him his advice. And he was coming from the background that the Bible proclaims it. The Bible has sent me on a mission. I am God's ambassador. I have his divine authority and his approval behind me. And he showed that power in Geneva. The final issue that we're dealing with tonight is sorrows. Strasbourg, we said, was pleasant. Back to Geneva, anything but. hard and harsh. He knew sorrow mentally through painful bereavements. His first son, Jacques, was born 28th of July, 1542. 2 weeks later, he died. Calvin wrote to his friend, Vere, "The Lord has certainly inflicted a severe and bitter wound in the death of our baby son. But he is himself a father and knows best what is good for his children." The kind of submission to the sovereign hand of God that he rendered in all of his trials. And he had another one. Very quickly afterwards, his wife, Idalette, was never well again. They had two more children who also died at or soon after birth. Then on the 29th of March, 1549, Idalette died of what was probably tuberculosis. Calvin wrote again to Verde, his friend, "You know well how tender or rather soft my mind is. Had not a powerful self-control been given to me, I could not have borne up so long. And truly mine is no common source of grief. I have been bereaved of the best companion of my life." So romance was alive and well in that relationship. Of one, he said, who, had it been so ordained, would have willingly shared not only my poverty, but even my death. During her life, she was the faithful helper of my ministry. From her, I never experienced the slightest hindrance. She was never troublesome to me throughout the whole course of her illness, but was more anxious about her children than about herself. As I feared these private worries might upset her to no purpose, I took occasion 3 days before she died to mention that I would not fail in discharging my duty towards her children. Calvin never remarried. No more time for romances. Just as well, the pace he kept would have left no time for wife or children. Physically, he had it hard because of poor health. The burden of work, the responsibilities that came upon him became a crushing labor by that continual poor health. Overwork in the days of his student times had impaired his digestion, that in turn increased by his own excitable and nervous disposition, brought on migraines. Later his lungs became affected, perhaps too much preaching and talking had done that, and he was incapacitated by lung hemorrhages. And as if that wasn't enough, then to add to the list, he was tortured by bladder stones and the gout, and yet still, with all of this, he drove his body beyond its limits. When he couldn't walk a couple of hundred yards into the church, he was carried on a chair to preach there. When the doctors forbade him to go out in the winter air to the lecture room, he crowded the audience into his bedroom and gave the remaining lectures on the book of Malachi there. He lamented a month. When looking over that month, he said, "My output has been a mere 20 sermons and 12 lectures. And you can hear his drivenness coming through in a letter to Falley in 1546. Apart from the sermons, he said, and the lectures, there is a month gone by in which I have scarce done anything. In such wise, I am almost ashamed to live thus useless." Where are Christians today? Dominated by that conviction. Ashamed to live a month that they perceived to have been quite useless. To those who would urge him to rest, he had the wondering question, "What would you have the Lord find me idle when he comes?" Hardness came through in the social sphere as well, through anything up to death threats. The opposition that Calvin faced in Geneva wasn't reasoned opposition. They were coming along, knocking the door, saying, "Mr. John, would you come out in here and have a bit of a debate and an argument? Let's have a structure to this debate." All the rest of it, they didn't do that. The opposition that he faced took the form of actual physical intimidation. Men set their dogs on him. They fired guns outside the church during the services that he was holding. There were people trying to drown out his voice, put him off by loud coughing whenever he preached. There were even anonymous threats against his life. We're told he was not unfamiliar with the sound of mobs outside his house in Geneva threatening to throw him in the river. Firing their muskets on his deathbed, Calvin said to a gathered group of pastors, "I have lived here amid continual bickerings. I have been from derision, saluted of an evening before my door with 40 or 50 shots of a large gun. And morally, it was hard to live there because of rampant sin In every city in Europe at the time, men held and kept mistresses. When Calvin began the ministry in Geneva, 1536, at the age of 27, there was a law in place in Geneva that said a man could keep only one mistress. And even after he'd been preaching as the pastor in St. Peter's Church over the next 15 years, this immorality was a plague still, even in the church, especially in the form of a group of people called the Libertines. For them, you might as well read the church at Corinth. They were boasting in their license by the communion of saints. They understood the common possession of goods and of houses and of bodies and of wives. And so they practiced adultery and they engaged in promiscuity in the name of Christian freedom. And then they turned up sitting in place for the Lord's table, expected to be served at the table of the Lord. Calvin opposed them. He opposed them vigorously, and they made life difficult for him. Why are we mentioning all of these sufferings and woes that came upon him in Geneva? Just to show that despite all the gathering opposition, he displayed incredible, even as one has termed it, invincible constancy in the ministry. A quality still needed today will be needed, I trust, I expect, more and more. During all of this turmoil, he hadn't thrown off his other responsibilities. He'd worked on the institutes that he was writing, and the 21 chapters of 1550 became 80 chapters, then divided into four books. He translated the institutes into French. He wrote a large commentary in the Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses, and he translated that. He continued to preach and lecture and perform his ordinary duties until the February of 1564, and nothing stopped him until death stopped him. At the age of 54, dying in the arms of a fellow reformer, Theodore Beza. He died with the words of the psalm on his lips, "O Lord, how long?" 27th of May, 1564. When Calvin passed on, this world lost a brilliant teacher. Spurgeon said he propounded the truth more clearly than any man who ever breathed. Schaff called him the king of commentators. John Murray said Calvin was the exegete, the Bible expositor, explainer of the Reformation. The world lost a faithful pastor. Half of his life, 27 years, he had served three pastorates, two of which were in the city of Geneva. The world lost a prolific author. Those institutes of his, published first when he was 27, grew with revisions from 85,000, gauge this with your theses at university, from 85,000 when they began, right up through to 450,000 words in his final edition. His commentaries were his largest undertakings, 45 large volumes, over 400 pages each, covering 75% of the Bible. Sermons, letters were printed, catechisms produced, confession of faith was brought out, devotionals, books on church order. In all, his collected writings fill 59 large volumes. The world lost in his death a brilliant teacher, faithful pastor, prolific author, zealous reformer. Truth, as he embraced it, he knew, had to have an impact to be of real value, and with him it did. He was a vibrant church planter. Now listen in. People say Calvinism stifles evangelism. Oh, right. He was very mission-minded. He sent out 88 missionaries from Geneva that were known. Many were not known because their identity was held for their own safety. He was sending them to France. They came to look upon his school of theology as a death school, because in going back to France, where persecution was rife, they realized, we're not going to live too long in preaching the gospel here. But they went. And through their efforts, Calvinistic teaching took root in France, and the gospel was published increasingly with a growing level of fruit. He was an indomitable worker, tireless, unwavering in his focus. Well, where do we go today to pay tribute to him? 500 years on, after his birth. You'll not find his gravestone, because he gave instructions strictly that he would be buried in the common cemetery with no tombstone. He didn't want to give any encouragement to those who might want to have a Protestant shrine. Today his gravesite is unknown. He might have worn out in 1564, his influence is not. outside his church and the Reformed fellowships. His ideas have been blamed for, credited for, depending on your view, the rise of capitalism, individualism and democracy inside the church. He has been a major influence on such figures as that evangelist George Whitefield and theologian in our own country, Dr. Henry Cook, among many other entire movements such as Puritanism and the Reformed churches. So what would he make of his anniversary today? And the past week when a lot of Christians around the world celebrated the 10th July 1509 as a turning point in world history. Well, the man who ridiculed relics and requested no tribute in death might shudder at the notoriety that he now has. But he would certainly appreciate learning how his writings about Christ, the only Saviour, have travelled around the globe and equipped generations of gospel ministers. Because still in memory, Calvin is the earthly admiral of the Reformation fleet.